particles hitting the Earth's magnetic field get directed into the North Pole and the South Pole area, and when those particles come in and hit the atmosphere, you see the light of their high velocity impact with the air, and that's what I think is causing the aurora.
That's true, then the aurora should be present and constant. Because aurora is changing, that we're talking about frequency of change. Now, is that frequency of change due to the fine, sweet spot of the frequency? Because whenever we have a magnetic field, we have the electrical charge. Whenever we have electrical charge, we have electromagnetic field. Back to you.
Comment. When you listen to NASA's astro weather site, whatever it's called, I can't think of the name of it right now, each time a major sunspot on the sun aims itself in our direction toward the Earth, because the sun rotates once every 27 or so days, when a major sunspot does a solar mass expulsion, in other words, it makes a great big bubble of material and launches a whole lot of material toward the Earth, you can predict exactly how many hours downrange you will see an aurora. I am of the belief that 90-some-odd% of that aurora, the frequency of the aurora, the intensity of the aurora, the timing of the aurora, can be told to you by the SOHO satellite looking at the sun, telling you when the next blast of solar wind is coming in our direction. NASA's been able to predict exactly when you're going to see an aurora many times. Go ahead, Alan, KC2RFN, KQRIW.
Yeah, you were talking about getting a current by the wind blowing over a dipole. Work has been done like that in a very clever way of amplifying the effect. Basically, a wind to electric converter, but not using any moving parts like a windmill. A man named Alvin Marks, back in the 50s, actually got on the cover of Popular Science, I believe, or it might have been Popular Mechanics. And what he did was very clever. He basically created a grid through which air can blow, high voltage on the grid, picks up a charge as the air particles, and it would have to be near a seashore, by the way, because apparently moisture played a role, of course. As that wet wind blew through the grid, picks up a charge, the wind would accelerate it past another grid where the energy from the wind very clever. And it looked like suspension bridges the way he had it set up. Do you follow that?
Yes, I think I do. Alvin Marks. So this is a non-moving part wind turbine. And any idea how much power he was able to get out of that? Alan, go ahead.
No, I don't remember, and he's deceased now, but we were friends for years, and we had talked about that. But it was impressive. But turbine wouldn't be the word. It was just a wind-to-electric generator, or converter, I guess we should call it, with no moving parts, and the thing really worked.
KC2, QIQ.
There's a kind of fan they have right now, an ionic fan. And you can actually suspend an object with this ionic fan with no moving parts. Go ahead, Glenn.
I'm just glad to hear that somebody else determined this, because I used to point out that LED when I was down in Florida. I mean, it would just only light one LED. But people were shocked. I was shocked by the fact that it would do it. And the funniest part about it was the more energy that would come out of it would be on a windier day. And, you know, you would think, okay, maybe there's a thunderstorm coming or something else, but it really was dependent on wind. And I would imagine that it also had some effects, maybe because there was like a salty air, you know, close to the coast there. But at least I'm glad to hear somebody else has verified it as well as I have, because that's about the oddest thing I've ever seen. And it was DC. There was no AC component on it. I was measuring it with a fluke meter. I mean, unless it was a bandwidth higher than the fluke meter, but I doubt it. And I was looking at DC voltage, and it was real. And I put it on an AC scale, I saw nothing. But it was, you know, predominantly a DC signal. I'm sure very, very light current. But still, you know, just to get an illumination in a dark shed on an LED, that means that, you know, there was probably some fraction of a milliamp in there, Dick. That's kind of impressive.
Well, Glenn, you said that either way, at least that's what I've heard from John, if I didn't hear that part, that whichever way you put the diodes, and then it was the light, that will actually contradict that this is the heat.
Was it a light-emitting diode, or was it a neon bulb, or was it both? And when there was no load there, no load device, your digital voltmeter showed how many volts. Back to you, Glenn.
Yeah, oddly enough, Dick, it was DC, and when I put a rectifier inside of it, I could control the polarity. And the reason I went for the diode was because when I put a voltmeter there, sometimes it was positive, sometimes it was negative. It would shift. It didn't stay in one polarity. And the funny part is sometimes it would stay in one polarity for a while. And then I was like, what if I put a diode in there? And then when I put the diode in, then I could control the polarity like forever. In other words, it would stay in that polarity. In other words, it would never shift. And it seemed to be dependent on the amount of wind. The stronger the wind was at the beach, the higher the voltage. But I never saw a voltage there higher than 300 volts. But I'd seen, days where it was very, very still, the air, and, it was maybe less than a volt on it. And, pretty much what you would just call, ground kind of noise picking up off the wire. And then other days where it was good, strong wind. Yeah, I think the highest voltage I ever saw was about 300 volts DC, Dick.
Only if you have a AC, you can put a diode anyway, and you will be able to put the LED on it.
Wait one second. Wesley, don't put words in my mouth. I'm telling you for sure it was DC. I could measure it with a voltmeter. The only reason I put the diode in there was so that I could control it so that it would only be in one direction, because sometimes the charge would reverse in the other direction. And as I said, I don't really have an explanation for it, but the way that the charge would build up could be controlled with the diode, so they would only build up charge in one direction. Because this way, I didn't want to like reverse bias the LED, a single LED, that would destroy it. Because when I did it the first time, it did destroy the LED, and the first time I thought it was getting zapped by like too much voltage, but that didn't make any sense because the voltage I measured on it was low when the LED was in there, but there wasn't enough current to light it. But what was interesting was that what was destroying it was the reverse. When it would flip around without something rectifying, it would eventually destroy the LED. And you would think that the LED itself would have enough rectification factor in the reverse direction, but it didn't.
And if you put the diode in it, the current didn't slow down, didn't diminish.
Was your diode assembly a bridge rectifier assembly in which either polarity would always come out with positive voltage? Over to you, Glenn.
No, Dick, I wish I had done that at the time, but it was just a single diode. It was because at the time I didn't have many diodes that were like 1,200 volt. And the 1,200 volt diode that I was using was a Motorola, I think 1100 series, 11000. It was a single diode. And but what was interesting is that when you did put the diode in there, it would control, in other words, the charge would only build up in one direction then, and that would be the direction of the diode.
When you put your voltmeter in the DC scale on that antenna and watched it, and you said occasionally it would go positive, occasionally it would go negative, tell me something about period. Would it go positive for half an hour and then flip negative? Would it slowly go positive and then flip negative? Would it sit negative for a day? Roughly, what kind of timing did you see on your DC voltmeter? Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, I never saw it change when the voltmeter was on it, but during a day, like if I would measure it at one time and then sometimes come back and measure it on another day or another time during the day, sometimes I would see negative. And the first time I thought it was just a measurement error, like I didn't have the leads on in the correct direction. And then I would go back, and then I was really watching it closely. And then a couple of different times I would just put the voltmeter on there and measure between that ground rod and that antenna. And sometimes it was positive, sometimes it was negative. But I never saw it reverse while the voltmeter was on there, Dick.
Now, NASA's got something to say about this. Let me drop it.
The current.
Yeah, I'm getting at that. Let me drop it. NASA sets up a whole bunch of these field mills, they call them. These are devices that measure polarity and magnitude of local E-field around launch pad 39A. And by measuring that local voltage, polarity, and magnitude, they know how close is a thundercloud, how likely is a lightning strike going to take place, and whether or not they should delay a launch accordingly. So measuring the voltage on the ground, measuring the E-field, NASA does it continuously. They got a whole bunch of these instruments scattered around the field. Many acres are covered in this manner. Now, you've never seen the polarity reversed on any one day. You'd come back another day and you'd see the polarity. However, if you sat and watched it for an hour, would the voltage slowly increase, slowly decrease? And even if it did, that just means a cloud is going by, I think. And when you measured that polarity, positive or negative, did you ever flip the meter over to the ampere scale and measure amperes? And along those lines, you keep saying light-emitting diode was lit in a dim room. Did you ever put a neon bulb on it? But once again, what kind of current did you see? That's what Wesley and I want to also know. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet. Fascinating stuff.
Yes, Dick. Actually, I did measure the current, and it was always less than a milliamp. It was always fractions of a milliamp. So when the wind was very, very light, and there was like no voltage, no current. Some days when the wind was really strong, I mean very, very strong, I think the highest current I've measured was like something like around, 0.9, just less than 1 milliamp.
And you've seen voltage as high as 300, and you said you were doing this in Florida. What town in Florida were you in, Glenn? Go ahead.
Flagler Beach. It's about 20 miles south of St. Augustine and about 17 miles north of Daytona Beach, Dick.
Why didn't the current damage the LED without the diode?
Apparently what was happening was that the LED itself didn't have the isolation voltage that the rectifier diode did. And if the voltage reversed, it destroyed the LED. That's what it was, a high voltage reverse polarity that built up on there and must have put the Zener into some kind of a Zener region and destroyed it.
What was the maximum current that the diode could hold?
I presume each of these light-emitting diodes have a PIV rating in volts and amps. Is that true, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this was not a sophisticated LED. This was just a little, green panel LED that I think, the maximum current you're supposed to run into them is like 5 milliamps. And, that's when they're nice and bright, I mean, when I'm saying it lit up, I'm not saying like this was going to blind you or anything. I'm just saying it was illuminating, inside a shed, where I had this thick wire coming in next to a shortwave radio. If I turned the light off inside the shed, you could actually watch this thing glow, and it was amazing. And the amplitude would change, but it really, if there was one thing it was definitely dependent on, was wind. The stronger the wind, definitely more amplitude on this thing, for sure. But you could control the polarity with a diode. That was fascinating to me.
Did you ever... We're going to go to Mel right after this. Did you ever try putting a neon bulb on there, or was it just light-emitting diodes? And how many years ago were you doing this, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, this was like around 91, 92. No, I never put anything other than a simple little panel LED in there. I tried a whole bunch of different things to see if I could get them to light up on there, but it was probably the only like low-power type of thing that would work. And when I saw it light up, it kind of took me back quite a bit, and because I didn't think that there would be enough current in there. That's when I started measuring the current with a with a little fluke ammeter. I think it was the 47, and it was just amazing that it was there. And nothing else pretty much I tried putting on there would even come close to illuminating, but except for this little cheap little panel LED.
One more comment.
Yeah, the light-emitting diodes you had in 1990, my guess is, were very low in efficiency compared to the ones today. Can you imagine if you used today's light-emitting diode on that exact same circuit? Glenn, go ahead and then pass it over. I know that Mel wants to say something. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, the other thing too, Dick, is now that I'm more and more I think about it, I bet you if I had put more in series, I probably could have gotten more of them to light in a series string. Because it seemed like the voltage was available there and the current, was certainly capable. So I would imagine if the voltages were getting up as high as 300, if I put a string in there, I might have been able to light up a few of them. But as I said, I had not seen that kind of amplitude and power coming off of an antenna wire since I was down there. But back to you, the K2RW, KC2QIQ.
One other quick question. What made you start doing this in the first place? You grabbed it with your hand and felt a current? Go ahead.
That's precisely it. I had this thing, dipole wire strung up around a portable shortwave radio, and it had one of those telescoping antennas, and I kind of just like twisted the lead of the open wire where the little leader came in and just wrapped it around the antenna. And occasionally I would have to use the workbench for something else, and I would just unwrap the coil of wire off of the antenna and to do some work on this workbench. And sure enough, while I was uncoiling it and I lifted it off, wow! I think it was like at the same time I was also touching something metallic that was grounded in the in the shed, and a piece of equipment that was grounded in there. And the differential between that and that item, boy, it gave me quite a zap.
How many miles was your town, was your QTH from Gainesville, the lightning capital of the world? And did you ever look at this during a thunderstorm? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, Gainesville is pretty far away. Gainesville, just to give you an idea, I was probably about an hour and 10 minutes from, say, the border of Georgia, and to get over to Gainesville would have been probably a good 2-hour ride from where I was, I'm not really sure exactly in how many miles it was. I think 117 would take you right over into Gainesville, off of 95 when you get up into the Jacksonville area and cut over. But yeah, it was pretty far away. And believe it or not, Dick, the worst lightning that I remember when I was down in Florida wasn't in Gainesville. The worst lightning I ever saw was along the road that goes between Daytona Beach down into the Tampa Bay area, and somewhere around like Tampa Bay, and right along that I-4. Wow, the lightning storms you'd see there would really set you back quite a bit.
Most of Florida gets a thunderstorm every afternoon. Did you ever look at the voltage when a thunderstorm went anywhere near the area?
Dick, after I saw that, all I would do is I would ground that wire, and I wouldn't even go near it on a daily lightning. Let's put it this way. In the type of lightning that you get in 3 o'clock in the afternoon where I was, because I was on the East Coast, the only thing between the ocean and where my house was A1A. My backyard was a dune. And when those storms would come in, literally you could watch them, and you'd have blue sky on one side, and you would just see a line of black clouds coming in your direction. And as that black cloud would come in, the storm front would be right there, and you'd see the wicked, wild lightning right on the edge of it. And that was the worst part of it. And my goodness, you would not want to be outside, near a wire, anything like that. I had witnessed people's houses where they didn't have correct grounding, and it would blow receptacles off the walls. Amazing lightning there.
Your antenna that was picking up this voltage was how many feet of wire, how high up, was it parallel to the ground?
Coiled. He said it was coiled.
No, it was never coiled, Wesley. It was a dipole type structure, but it was within n feet of wire. I would say that the height of the shed where it was terminated with a little insulator on one side was probably somewhere around like 8-9 feet off the ground, and the palm tree that it was tied to on the other side might have been up around 25 feet. It was a pretty large size palm on the other end, and it was about. It was a pretty decent-sized piece of property. I would say that the total length was probably around 45 feet thick.
So it's a sloper-like antenna. And was it end-fed or center-fed? And was it you said dipole. Was it fed with what kind of transmission line, Glenn?
Loosely confederated wording there. No, it was just a long wire. And then off of the long wire where the insulator was on the end, I just had a piece of, I believe it was like 22-gauge insulated wire twisted around around this long wire and just kind of ran it through one of the little side openings. I think it was a little vent opening on the top of the shed there inside. and because it was a wooden shed, and just you know, kind of like droop the that wire alongside a little receiver.
Fantastic. Mel, you're near the seashore. You get lots of wind. You've got lots of wire in the air. Have you ever done any experiments like this? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Only one time I had a connector hanging loose of it with a PL59 on it, 259 on it, and it was from that time a long wire also, was a ZEP. Yep, it was a ZEP antenna, and I saw it ticking. I saw a click across that PL259. I grounded it, everything like that, and I've always had it now that everything is now short at the ground. I don't take any chances. But I'll tell you about an experience. My friend in Pennsylvania, he said they had began to get a severe case of an arcing noise and everything. It was got to the point where they heard his telephone. He said he was on the receiver. He said it was across the band. It would get very severe and then sometimes let down a little bit. He says, but never really went to nothing. They complained to the power company, and they spent a lot of time finding it. And the final reason, they said, they, you know, looked, sounded like one of those high voltage insulators was breaking down on one of those high tension overhead systems, you know, carries those couple hundred thousand volts on those high iron towers that go across, you know, the area. And they found, basically, let me drop. They finally found the source, and it was a farm that had a building with a metal roof. And where the two, and where two sheets of the metal come together, parted. Just, you know, the building, I guess, was an old building, and the old sheet metal just started to where it was seen, just parted, and it was actually arcing between the two sheet metal, pieces of sheet metal on the roof. And it was a distance from the high tension line. And I'd say, gee, I wonder if you could tap that roof, you know, just separate it off so it wouldn't arc. Could you tap that roof and get free electricity? Over.
Yeah, I think you could, but you're not going to get a whole lot of power. So the arcing was the sheets of metal with a gap between them on the roof. And how was that creating grief in a private home some number of houses away? Over to you, Mel.
Arcing was setting up an RF that was going across the spectrum. He says, you'd hear it. He says, building up sometimes, you'd hear it in radios. He says, you even heard it on the phones. He says, it was very severe at times. That's why the power company was called in, that they thought that they had a severe, they said the severe breakdown of one of those high voltage insulators. But after they went and had did all that troubleshooting, they found it was the metal plates on the roof. I was wondering, could it really produce that kind of power and radiate like that? But my friend sits on it. My friend George says, I'm telling you what it was. No, it was phenomenal, the way that was taking place, that arc. They had pictures of it. That was, this was, you know, jumping a good gap over.
Did they fix that by putting a metal strap across that gap?
Actually, that was the fix. Just bonded everything together, and it fixed it. So, what can I tell you? I would assume that with lightning also, you can most likely get the same kind of situation. It'll come and go, but this was more or less constant. The only thing that made a change
was when it rained.
One more thing I wanted to ask you about magnets. I saw something very interesting with magnets. I was curious if you had to see this thing, Dick. Go ahead first.
My guess is that arcing was at a 60-cycle rate, that if you looked at the audio output from the receiver that's getting the interference and you synchronized it to the 60-cycle line, you would see two spikes across that screen and the positive half voltage and the negative half voltage, but most likely no one did that. Back to you, Mel, for any comment on that one.
There's no doubt it was 60 cycles because it was going across those high-powered lines and everything. But, you know, to hear that, that you can actually see the arc. And I was curious, gee, to make an arc like that, you've got to build up, you know, a considerable amount of voltage. Just like, for instance, if you put a spark plug between these two plates, and you could box plug continuous, you got to be producing some appreciable amount of power, Dick, over.
I'm guessing it's only a fraction of a watt, but it sure would be a fun experiment. I know Wesley wants to ask some questions on this. Go ahead, Wesley.
I wonder how big was the square footage of that roof. And I'm still trying somehow to connect that the roof to the turret plate of the capacitor. My understanding was that the wire that Glenn used, if you calculate the square inch area of that wire, that actually is in direct connection with how much voltage you could produce, even though that we stand that it's a DC voltage. But I understood that the LED was 5 milliamps, and there was never more than 1 milliamp on the LED. Just if Glenn could educate me how come less than 1 milliamp could damage 5 milliamp LEDs. Back to you, Dick.
1 milliamp can easily damage a rectifying diode when you use it in the peak inverse voltage reading. Let's assume now that I have a diode that's used for power rectifying, for a high voltage power supply, and it's rated for 600 volts of peak inverse voltage. And the possibility exists that this particular diode in my hand, rated for 600, conservatively by the manufacturer, and he's worried about the rating, so he knows that people are going to take 600 volts RMS out of a transformer, which really is something like 900 volts peak, and so maybe the diode really is good for almost 1,000 volts before it fully breaks down. If I have 1 milliampere of current in the reverse direction on that diode at 1,000 volts, 1 milliamp at 1,000 volts is 1 watt. And so if 1 watt is being dissipated in that little chip inside the diode, I think it could damage it. And I'm guessing his light-emitting diodes are only good for some number of milliwatts of dissipation in the peak inverse rating mode before damage. Any idea what the PIV of those diodes were that you were using? And you could have been putting 300 volts across it in the wrong direction. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, these were really inexpensive diodes from Radio Shack, and LED diodes. And the I didn't really, find any ratings on them. I mean, they give you the forward drop rating that was on them. They were like, 2 volts, I think 2.2 volts forward, and they gave you, like 10 milliamps max, and they were supposed to be operated, I think they were 250 milliwatt, right? I think that was their maximum rating, and, that was basically it. And I mean, if you use it at those maximum ratings, it won't last long. So that's a big derated thing, and you described it perfectly, Dick, because I took a power supply, just a regular, power supply, limited, current limited to, like a half a milliamp, and I started increasing the voltage on the on those little LEDs, and when I got somewhere like around 30 volts, they started to fail. So that was the name of that tune.
When they failed, did you see a flash of light? I mean, how did you know failure occurred? Did it suddenly become a short circuit? Yes, it wouldn't light when you go forward. But while you're doing the reverse current test on a power supply, and you're monitoring voltage and current, during that peak inverse voltage test that you were doing with that power supply, did you see something on the light-emitting diode itself, or did you see something on the meters that told you just blew that diode, that LED? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, when I was running the LED in the reverse direction, I increased the voltage, and up to about 12 volts, I didn't see any leakage at all. And then basically when I got to like around 30 volts on the little lab supply or something a little less than that, maybe around 25, all of a sudden I basically just saw it go into current limit. It was a current limited lab supply, and it was just shorted out after that.
So when it would start drawing current, I think you're saying the voltage of the power supply would jump down to zero because you were current limited? So in other words, the failure mode was the light-emitting diode became almost a short circuit?
Exactly. That's what I saw. It was just a breakdown, and boom, it just shorted right out. So you know, it was kind of like a Zeenering effect, and then it just shorted.
Sure would have been fun to put a whole string of any two neon bulbs onto that circuit. I had the impression that if the wire was higher and longer, you might have, on a windy day, gotten more current out of it. I don't think you get more voltage, but you get more current. And the mechanism by which the wind blowing creates voltage on a wire of various polarities. And by the way, would you see a positive voltage 80% of the time, a negative voltage 20% of the time? What's your guess, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, what I was seeing initially was that it was random, you know, and you know, sometimes I would just go over there, sometimes it was positive, sometimes it was negative. And I would say it was pretty close to 50-50, Dick. And there again, it was only on really windy days that you'd really see this phenomenon. So it wasn't really, I mean, there were days I would just go out there where there was no wind, and you'd see nothing on it. You know, it was just very, very still, you know, summer's afternoon, you'd see nothing. But the most often when I would see it would be, you know, like in the afternoon when you get that wind just before the storms. Yeah, and even though there weren't lightning storms yet, it was just sunny. Did you see that wind start to build up? And usually that was an indicator that probably in a couple of hours there would be a storm coming along. So it kind of does agree with everything you were saying about NASA. And there again, I'm just glad to hear that there are more people that have seen this effect. Because the first time I saw it, and I tried to explain it to people, they were like, no way. Like, here, come on, take a look. Here it is.
Where you were living, Glenn, was there a prevailing wind direction? In other words, did 90% of the time the wind come to you from the southwest, for instance? And on those few days that, and when you saw a reverse polarity, is there any possibility that the days of reverse polarity, the wind was blowing in the other direction? Any guesses on this one, Glenn?
Yeah, the winds would generally follow the coastline, and they were pretty much always from the south, you know, south going north. That was the predominant wind along the beach over there. And what was interesting is this antenna was basically perpendicular to the seashore. So in other words, even though I was just on the dunes in maybe like around 500 feet from the ocean itself, the antenna would have been, perpendicular to the ocean. So the wind was basically to the broad side of this antenna. And the stronger the wind, and I can't really blame it on wind direction. The only thing I can, you know, as far as polarity goes, but I do know that, and because that was relatively random when it would shift, and I don't think it was wind direction, but if there's one thing I can say with certainty, is that when the wind speed increased, the stronger that wind was, the more energy that was on that wire, for sure.
Coming.
You got it, Wesley.
My understanding is that the voltage was always present, whether the antenna was used or wasn't used. So at the same time, when you had a steady voltage, you did have a different kind of frequency or a variable current flowing due to the electromagnetic waves on that antenna. Now, your receiver was able to receive that a frequency. My question is then, could it be possible that there is a presence of another voltage that is a variable frequency or AC voltage on that on the same piece of wire? And another question is, if that metal roof was connected similar way and fashion, would we have more light? Back to Dick.
Yeah, on the subject of diode polarity, which is close to what Whistley is asking right now, if, for instance, you had a day where the antenna was giving you positive voltage, and then you put the diode on there so that the anode of the diode is connected to the antenna, the cathode is connected to the light-emitting diode, the diode would light. And on that particular setting of the diode plus LED, if the voltage reversed, I'd like to believe that the diode would not light. And correspondingly, if the polarity of the voltage on the antenna was positive, but you put the cathode of the diode there, which now means you're rectifying diode is reversed in polarity, I'd like to believe that now you would not light the light-emitting diode. Is that true? Because Wesley is going down the road saying that maybe there's something else going on, that with the diode intentionally set in the reverse polarity, you still got positive voltage out of the diode. And if that's true, there's something else going on here. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Well, for sure it was DC, but the polarity would shift, and when I put something in there to rectify it, so that the charge would build up in one direction, it would always follow the diode. So regardless of whether that day the charge on the antenna was plus or minus, if I put a diode in there, I could change the polarity that day, regardless of whatever the polarity was. So as long as it was wind, if I put a diode in there, the charge would build up according to the current flow of the diode. So in other words, the diode was the dominant factor, not everything else surrounding it. So the diode was a controller. So in other words, I could make the polarity whichever direction I wanted to the minute I put a diode in there. And which, you know, here again, I was looking for an AC effect then. Was it rectifying? No. It just basically, once there was a current path established, whether it was through a resistor, a diode and a resistor, or with, just an LED, the polarity would be fixed. But what would happen is, the reason I had to put the diode in there eventually was because the first time I did it with the LED, I didn't have a diode, and I left it connected there. And what would happen is, I would come back, and like a couple of days later, and the LED failed. And I'm like, why did the LED fail? And then after the LED was failed, it was shorted, I lifted it up, and then I saw a positive voltage there. Even though it was a low voltage right on the shorted LED, it was towards the positive end. So I was like, And that's when I decided to go for the rectifier deck.
Yeah, there's a couple of ambiguities here, though, Glenn. If you chose a day where the antenna into your voltmeter was giving you positive voltage, and you put the anode of the diode there and the cathode to the LED, everything's hunky-dory. If you put the cathode of the diode on the antenna, when the antenna was giving you positive voltage, you said it would reverse polarity. Does that mean the antenna would now produce negative voltage? I don't think you were saying that. Or were you saying that you would get negative voltage out of the rectifier into the LED? Which were you saying, Glenn, when you put the diode rectifier in the so-called reverse direction for the apparent polarity of the antenna for that day? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Okay, let me explain it a little bit more clear. I had a ground rod that eventually I put in the ground, and this is when I started getting serious with this and measuring it. I put a 10-foot ground rod in the ground. I ran that wire into the bench. That point over there, from that point forward, when I used a diode, I was called minus. And then what I did was I took a diode with a cathode facing toward the ground rod. So that in the cathode side, I was calling plus. And I took the anode and attached that to the antenna. Okay? Now, if I were to open the circuit and I measured on the anode side within an open circuit and then just use a voltmeter between the ground rod and the antenna, it could be plus or minus in an open circuit. The minute the diode was attached to the LED, it would always build up in the positive direction. Even if it was a day when it was negative there before I closed the circuit, the minute the circuit was closed, it would follow the polarity of the diode. QSL?
I have a very interesting question. Does it mean that the electron flows from the ground to the antenna? Because some days you had reverse polarity. As normally it's thought that ground is the minus.
That's one question, and related to that, are you telling me that regardless of the polarity of the antenna all by itself, that when you connected the rectifier into the circuit, you made it sound like the antenna always readjusted itself to forward bias the rectifying diode? Is that what you were saying, Glenn? Go ahead.
100% unequivocally, that's what I'm saying, and that was what was observed. And I explained this to quite a few people, and I brought it back to a couple of universities and asked a few people about this. And what their comment to me was that basically electrical charge always wants to find equilibrium. And the minute you create a circuit path, it will always follow the direction of the circuit path. So when the diode becomes the dominant direction, the polarity of basically the rub off on that antenna is basically going to always follow that polarity. So it will, when it's an open circuit, it's undefined. So when you put a voltmeter inside there, the polarity is not defined yet. So it could float in either one or the other direction. But the minute the diode's inside there, then that becomes the determining factor, and the polarity will follow that path to ground because that's the easiest path of resistance.
For reasons I don't understand, I was hearing Wesley on the input, but he wasn't coming through the machine, as if the PL was turned off. Glenn, if I had a flashlight battery on the table, and I take the positive lead of the flashlight battery, connect it to the anode of the diode rectifier, obviously I can get current out of that circuit. If I connect the cathode of the rectifier to the positive lead of the flashlight battery, I can never get any current out of that circuit, even though electricity tries to find its lowest energy point and flow in the right directions, whatever. In the case of a flashlight battery, I will get no current flow. If I choose the day when your antenna was positive, and I put the cathode of your rectifying diode on the antenna, at first you would think no current would flow. You're telling me that was previously a positive polarity antenna would suddenly become negative in polarity, and now current would flow through the rectifying diode into the light emitting diode and light it up. As you can see, that's a little bit strange, but I think that's what you're telling me. Over to you, Glenn.
Question?
John recognized, but apparently what's going on here, Dick, and I said it because I've done this experiment enough times to really know, and it is definitely a fact that when the diode's in that direction, it's not a battery, you know, where all the primary carriers are stored in the battery in one direction. Apparently a cloud relationship to a piece of wire and wind flowing through it has the capability of being positive and or negative. In other words, there's just enough carriers of energy inside that cloud hitting that piece of copper that it could go one direction or the other. But the minute that you've created a polarity and a direction, you know, a path to ground, it will immediately favor the path to ground. In other words, if you didn't have a diode there and you put a current meter on it and attached it to ground, it could be plus, it could be minus. It just depends on whichever direction it favors. But if you put a diode in there, it will always favor that direction because it can only flow in one direction. So apparently this effect, which I don't completely understand myself, but in other words, the way that the energy or, you know, the charge building up on the antenna is definitely associated to the path, the electrical path. And if there's no electrical path, the charge could build up in either direction. But once you put a defined path in there, it will always follow that direction. And I've done the experiment enough times to see that it does work. That's why I just wish, more people could see this effect. It is an amazing thing.
Wild. I got more questions, but go over to John first. Go ahead, John.
So, Dick, Glenn mentioned something that I was thinking about, and I wondered what would happen if we put a galvanometer without any diodes anything to ground, but he already answered that question. So, evidently, it's just a question of it's a steering diode. Whether it's positive or negative, it's going to cause it to discharge whichever direction the diode is in. That's what I believe is happening.
The only what I don't understand is that then it looks like electrons flow from ground to the lower state of energy. It is exactly what I think in my email.
Yeah, but when he's got different polarities on different days, some days the electrons are flowing into the ground, some days they're flowing out of the ground. Glenn, did you ever measure the voltage on the antenna while it's connected to the diode and light-emitting diode? Over to you, Glenn.
No, absolutely. You know, cathode voltage is always like around 2.1 volts. The current inside there was like, say typically it was like around a half a milliamp, and the anode was always just like another, about 600 millivolts above, basically what I was measuring on the cathode side. And then when you open up the circuit, what you'd get on the other end. Sometimes it would be positive, sometimes it would be negative. It's an amazing thing. And here's another thing that a couple of people from university who are more interested than just about anybody else while I was down there were mentioning from their electrophysics department from University of Miami, because I was, you know, in contact with them a bit. And what they were basically saying is that the wind direction and charge of lightning, in other words, when you see a streak of lightning and you see that streak across the sky, the current isn't flowing down the streak. It's flowing in little micro arcs from one side to the next. So when you're seeing a large streak of lightning, you're actually, the micro arc is between one cloud on one side and one cloud on the other side, and that's the streak you see. So basically, the charge differential is all over the place in these things. So when you have a piece of wire up there and you create a path, the amount of charge differential is always available. It's just a matter of creating a path for it. KC2, QIQ.
Does it mean that then the lightning should go from the air to the cloud? Because this is the same mechanics that you were describing.
Can I repeat this, Dick? Well, okay, Wesley, what they told me in the university is that the model of lightning going from the sky to the ground is not really a good model. The lightning can go from cloud to cloud, from ground to sky, from sky to ground. It can go whatever direction the potential is in. If one cloud is positive on one side and the other cloud is more negative on the other side, it will arc that way. If the cloud on the other side is positive, the other one's minus, it will arc back the other direction. If it's more on the cloud to a ground point, it will arc in that direction. And it depends on whether the cloud is more positive or minus than the ground. It could go in any of those directions, any of those possibilities. KC2, QIQ.
Wow, Glenn, you are great. You created my adrenaline going all the way to the sky. That means that ground could be positive or negative. Doesn't ring the bell for you, Dick?
Whenever we talk about polarity, we're talking about polarity with reference to something. If a positively charged cloud comes by, it will think the ground is negative. If a negatively charged cloud comes by, it'll think the ground is positive. It's relation to the nearby thing. All that I've been reading about lightning tells me that cloud-to-cloud lightning is very prevalent, maybe a little bit more prevalent than cloud-to-ground. And the majority of the lightning that occurs cloud-to-ground is negative cloud, cloud negatively charged. And when you do get the cloud creating the lightning that's positively charged, those are the lightning bolts that are not multiple strikes, they're only one strike, one stroke, and they tend to be 10 times bigger in current and maybe 10 times higher in power. They're the ones that do a lot of damage and kill people a lot more easily. So can you say the ground is positive or say the ground is negative? I think the ground is close to the same potential as far as the universe is concerned. But what really counts is what is the polarity of the cloud. And yes, I will admit that when a positively charged cloud comes by, more electrons will gather underneath it in the Earth. The electrons do kind of bunch together, getting ready to arc that path. And there's lots of evidence that that happens. Now, if I understand you correctly, Glenn, you could have an open circuit where you've got nothing but the voltmeter on the antenna. You close the circuit, and let's assume that the antenna was positively charged, and you've got the cathode of the rectifying diode about to be connected to the antenna. Anode goes to a light-emitting diode and then the ground. So you've got the diode rectifier in the reverse polarity.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You're looking at the polarity of the voltage on the antenna. And you've got the opposite polarity of the diode. You got the cathode of the rectifier about to be connected to the antenna, but the antenna was positive. You close the circuit. The cathode of the diode is now connected to the antenna. The previously positive antenna jumps to negative voltage, negative about 1 volt, in order to get the 600 volts on the diode plus the lighting meter. You go to minus 2 volts, let's say. So you had a positive plus 300 antenna, close the circuit in that manner, and it suddenly becomes a minus 2-volt antenna and lights up the diode. That's what I think you're saying, and my goodness, that is strange. Over to you, Glenn.
KC2WYE.
Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Dick, that's what I observed, and it is a strange a property than I can possibly imagine. As I said, it was not what I was expecting, and that's what I saw. And as I said, and I brought it to enough people and asked them about it, and they kept on giving me all of the definitions that I thought of lightning. They completely crushed my world. And they would tell me another thing. Like, I always thought that, like, if you were insulated, like in a car, during a lightning storm, that you were safe. Or if you had, you know, the idea that if you stepped in a puddle, you were more likely to get struck by lightning than if you were in dry ground. And they completely rocked my world there, too. They started telling me things like, when storm fronts come in, the most dangerous part of the storm front is the lightning, is the difference in air pressure from one side to the other side. So in other words, it's not necessarily earth to ground. It could be east to west. So if you're standing in an open field and a lightning storm is coming in from the west and the air pressure behind you in the east, okay, as the storm is moving across, the most dangerous point is the east to west clouds. And if you get caught between the two clouds at ground level, it's actually arcing through you, not necessarily into the ground at all. KC2, QIQ.
In the case of the safety you get from an automobile, it's not that the automobile is insulated from ground with the rubber tires. It's the fact that there's a Faraday cage, a metallic conducting cage of automobile around you. That's what gives you the safety. Once you're inside the car, you are reasonably safe from lightning, and whether or not you're on rubber tires or the rubber tires are gone and you've got the metal rims right on the ground, the amount of safety to you is the same. It's the metal cage around you that's giving you the protection. I promised Eric that if he came back, we would at least listen to his question. So, Eric, go right ahead. KC2, Whiskey, Italy, India. Now, here we go. WIE, you got it, Glenn. Eric, K2RIW.
Just one more quick comment on that?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
I'm sorry, but I just had to mention this. They showed me photographs of cars that had gotten literally ripped apart by lightning in Florida, in the Tampa area, where people were in, and first I thought it would be just like something like a convertible. But no, these were cars where actually the windows were slightly open so that, or that there was some kind of airflow inside the car, and actually the charge inside the car conducted through the glass. So in other words, it depends on the air pressure inside the car and the storm, how it's passing by. So you can get actually arcing through the glass, and actually the people inside the car get electrocuted. And people have died from this in Florida. They say about 10 per year, Dick, on average. Back over to you, KC2, QIQ.
Wow. That's a new one on me. Eric, go right ahead.
KC2WIE. Originally my question related to the research you're doing on the with regard to magnetic energy, but I have a quick comment with regard to the discussion that you're having now. Ground current, especially, you know, if you're near a utility or a railroad, can behave very strangely in terms of polarity. And that's what you may be experiencing with regard to your measurements.
I hear what you're saying. You better hurry, because the machine truly becomes turned off at 1 o'clock in 3.5 minutes. You got it, Eric?
I'll leave it at that and let you continue your discussion. Like I said, the behavior of ground current becomes, what we know as, what we accept as normal behavior with regard to ground current, it becomes a little bizarre when you're operating around a railroad or a utility where you may have leaking cables or ground currents leaking from the traction power equipment.
For final comments?
Go ahead, Wesley.
Well,
remember my question. Is electron flowing from the device to the ground or from the ground to the device? Now we got to the conclusion that the extraction of the energy from the air is possible at least one time because of the lower stage. So then the electron will flow from the ground to the lower stage. Dick, back to you.
Yeah, if I've got a wire connected to a ground rod, and I'm doing various experiments like the ones that Glenn is describing, depending on what day and how he does the experiment, we can't say that the current always flows from the ground rod to his experiment, or always flowing from his experiment to the ground rod. I think depending on what was the experiment and what he's doing, I think he can get current flowing in either direction. What do you think, Glenn?
I agree, Dick, because as I said, I don't think that this is like a battery type of circuit. This is really just a, you know, energy that's in the air, and the polarity is always looking for a path. Now, I know if there's no diode in there, the current can flow at random in whatever direction that it wants to. It's just that apparently if the diode's inside there, it just kind of like forces it in one direction, and that's basically kind of what I saw. And the you know, and I had done it enough times to see that even on a day where it was positive, I put the diode in there, and all of a sudden, you know, it flipped around in the other direction. So always follow the circuit current direction. So as long as it had some kind of path to flow, it would always favor that. Now, granted, I do admit one thing, though. In the days where it was positive before I put the diode inside there, it would light brighter, or I'd get a little bit more current if I started in the initial direction that I saw that charge in. So if I took the favored direction and put the diode in, I'd get a little bit more out of it. But not a lot more, Dick. It was amazing. You reverse it in the other direction, you still get energy going through it, well, just because it found up a path. Back to you, Dick.
Comment.
That is wild stuff. We may not get a chance for that comment. This was TechNet number 1,326. In 30 seconds, we're going to be cut off. Try to be kind to each other. Mel, why don't you say your goodbyes? K2KEY, K2LIW. You guys are crazy. We got to go to work tomorrow. You got to go out, Mel.
Okay, just want to say goodnight. We saw something very interesting about magnets, but we'll leave that for another time. 73's all. Take care. Have a great week.
Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1,738 with a release date of Friday, December 3rd, 2010 to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. A jammer of ham radio communications is convicted in a United Kingdom court, but nobody knows why he did it. We have the details. Also, a new broadband threat to ham radio on 75 and 80 meters in a tiny modem from France. And it's time to say goodbye to an old friend from Sony. Find out the details on Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1738, coming your way right now. From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's independent, on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, from Charleston, West Virginia, here's Jeff Clark, K-8-J-A-C. Well, it's taken the better part of 4 years, but a jammer of amateur radio repeater operations in the United Kingdom has been brought to justice. Jeremy Boot, G4NJH, is in Nottingham with the details.
A Hull resident was sentenced at Hull Crown Court on the 22nd of November for causing deliberate interference to amateur radio users in the Hull region of Humberside between June and November 2009. The defendant was also convicted of unlawfully using radio equipment without a license from Ofcom, which was installed in his van and driven around the region to interfere with legitimate users of the local amateur frequencies.